we want to share with you experiences with one of my grandmas. I've had two grandmas that I knew, and I've known all my grandparents, but one grandma was, you know, had a real significant influence in my life. When my grandpa died back in 1966, she opened her home to Chinese students who attended PLU. She opened her home to a mother and newborn baby, which started a series of little family communities in her home next to PLU. And the reason that she was so good at developing these little tiny communities, she was such a good communicator, good storyteller, and she was a good listener. I remember Grandma is always having the time to sit and listen. The coffee pot was always on, the cookie jar was always full, and we'd sit there and just visit, and everything was always okay. She could always relate stories to what was going on, and we felt very safe in whatever we needed to share. I think, and we could talk about any subjects that were important to me, or what was going on in the world. We just talked about whatever we wanted. Everyone who met her eventually started calling her Grandma. I think some of you might know people and have had that same experience. We have discovered a book that just came out in 1987 that expresses some of the thoughts that we have about communications and how it relates to community. And my dad right now is going to read something in this book. As he reads, when he stops, there's a series of statements. So if you have any kind of response and think of something that relates to that, please raise your hand and share with us.
I should just start by saying this has been probably one of the most pleasant experiences that we've had for many years at Holden Village. I think I came here some over 20 years ago with the PLU group, either alumni board or board of regents or something, as I worked with them. But the last few years, I've come with Karen and her children, and we've been joined during that time by a very busy father, so David has joined us to help, and if we need help, we will call on David. And also, Karen's sister-in-law, Mimi, has come and joined us with one of her children, Julianne. So we kind of feel we really have support tonight. But for Karen and for me, as father and daughter, we've had some wonderful experiences over the years. And I know that we'll hear some of that sharing tonight about some of the experiences that you've had too. But this week with these sessions, it's just been a joy to me to share this time with Karen. And when she talks about my mother was lots of fun too, as grandmas are. And at the time, it was kind of interesting. There's one little book here too at Holden that says How to Grandparent. So I mean, if you want to know all the answers, they got it here in the bookstore. But this one was kind of cute in the beginning, although the chapter is very, very serious. It talks about grandparents' divorce in the single-parent family. We're not going to dwell necessarily on that, but we did have some comments yesterday about the number of single-parent families that have an effect. But here's the one statement. Grandmas are always slow, but they do not mind because they have all the time in the world. And that was written by Malcolm Andrew, age 10. So, you know, he had it down pat. Grandma had some time to know Malcolm. That's one little book that was here. Now, the book that Karen bought the day we left for Holden is a good book, and you're going to hear it, and you'll see people carrying it around because I think it's going to have quite a bit of influence. It's the author of this book is also author of The Road Less Traveled. Yeah. And some of you may have already seen that book. Dr. Scott Peck, a psychiatrist, psychotherapist, who has given up practice to devote his time strictly to community making and peace. He lives in Connecticut, and that's all he does. But he has, in his latest book, he has a chapter on community and communications. coming from the same stem, and it talks about the developing of community, and one of the ways that is done is through, of course, communication. That was the main topic that we had as we came to Holden for this week. We are going to talk generally in the area of family communications through a father-daughter dialogue system, and so we've been talking about this subject. We had planned 5 sessions, which we have reduced to 3, so we won't be able to fully develop all that we want to. But anyway, we did want to comment on the idea, and Scott Peck says, since communication is the bedrock of all human relationships, the principles of community have profound application to any situation in which 2 or more people are gathered together. Peacemaking and reconciliation, or community making, is not just a global matter, because here we talk, you know, a lot about global matters, and we talk a lot about national matters, and we have dealt in the last 2 weeks a lot on community building, peacemaking, reconciliation, and relationships. But is not just a global matter, it is a matter of concern within any business, any church, any neighborhood, and family. And of course, our basic element of discussion in these 3 sessions that we have has to do with essentially family, whatever form that takes in this communications relationship. And so, I notice all the times we're taken. I'd like to have done a morning matins and just challenged a little bit on some thoughts that Scott Peck gives on the true meaning of community. It's I've been really very much impressed with this. He states in here, community is something more than the sum of its parts, its individual members, and we usually say the whole is the sum of its parts. Scott Peck says that it's more than that when it comes to community, and I think we can all kind of feel that sense. And when you read his statement, you get a sense of that. Family is more than just the individual members. It's the basic unit of our society still. And we talked a little bit yesterday about the idea that even in a single-parent family, it is still a family. It is still a community. Or if you expand it to grandma and grandpa and aunts and uncles and foster children and so forth, you're still developing a family and a community. And I tried to break this out into about 8 or 10 points, and I'm going to read them just to challenge your thinking. Community is and must be inclusive. I think we all recognize occasionally in almost any situation when it becomes exclusive, we have an exclusivity about it, then we start to break down the whole idea of community. One of his friends, he also says, community, like marriage, requires that we hang in there when the going gets a little rough. It requires a certain degree of commitment. And you remember Bella, who is such a good writer. You have a book by Bella, too, don't you, Bob? Bella, didn't he write Heart?
Habits of the Heart.
Yeah, Habits of the Heart.
We have that at home.
It is no accident that Bella, subtitled Work, Individualism, and Commitment in American Life, our individual must be counterbalanced by community. And we talk about rugged individualism in America today, and that has to be balanced out, and more we're talking about community. Certainly the Rainbow Experience this week was a wonderful example of how we are working in community. And he also tells about a friend who indicated to him that a community, correctly defined, is a group that has learned to transcend its individual differences. Again, you look at the family relationship and how important that is. He says a second characteristic of community is that it is realistic. We talk a lot about, as we deal in our families, we have to keep a high level of being realistic. And he talks about some of his examples of in his marriage of how he and his wife together making decisions that relate to children, that the decision that they make as in that community of family is always better when the two of them participate in it. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday too.
In our case, we have grandpa and grandma and grandpa and grandma and great grandma and mom and dad and aunts and uncles. And you know, we start talking about families, we have all this input, which is, you know, yeah, I mean, my dad says, the advice is cheap, and you don't have to accept it, but it's always there. But at least that input's there. And I think the more ideas you get, sometimes the better your answer might be to a certain problem.
He also goes on to say something about an important aspect of this dealing with realism is that we need to look at the whole idea of humility, our humility and our community, our family, community relationships. And in dealing with humbleness or community, I think I remember someone saying that about humility when he discovered it, he had lost it. The other thing is that it is contemplative, and the whole concept of know yourself, know thyself, is a sure rule to becoming humble. And we look at ourselves, that happens. He talks about the other thing in community, in family too, which Karen commented about the little communities or family communities that my mother formed, that I feel safe here, he says, that it is a safe place. And family becomes a wonderful safe harbor to turn to. Another characteristic of community is that it's healing and converting. And I think of families being a place where a lot of difficult times can be healed so well. And we know what the effect of the family's been on that. Community requires the ability to expose our wounds and weaknesses to our fellow men and women. And then he says in community there are no sides. In a genuine community there are no sides. I think we recognize that in dealing with family. Another essential characteristic of community is its total decentralization of authority. And Scott Peck talks a lot about that in many areas other than family. He talks about it globally, nationally, government-wise, and so forth. We hear some of that in school today. A lot about decentralization of the more authoritarian hierarchical systems to allow what happens in the schools to happen in the community of the classroom. Classroom becomes a community for a teacher. Talks about community as a spirit, and community spirit is understood in that kind of situation, and then that there, in a community, there is a spirit of peace. And finally, he says, in terms of his own reference, that since it is Christian, that it's the spirit of peace and love that comes is the spirit of Jesus. And in that spirit, he looks at that in terms also in community, that he speaks then of the presence of God and the Holy Spirit. So he comes out with a final statement that the wisdom that comes in a community becomes miraculous, and that in that kind of spirit. The reason I sum that book is that I think you'll be seeing something of that in groups that are talking about community building. And I would look at it, I think I'll take it back and look in terms of maybe an adult study on terms of community in the church. But anyway, we want to talk a little more about family tonight, but I wanted to share that with you because of the little communities that have been formed in our family life over a period of many, many years.
Are there any comments about any of those statements in there that you can relate to your lives, or something that has happened?
Yeah, I have one that I think might be appropriate here. The community that I tried to build, because I feel very strongly about this, when my children were little, I felt that the dinner table was a time that I could build community. and it really sort of held that sacred. But of course, children grow up and they move away, and my children now are age 29, 31, 33, 35, mm-hmm. which astounds me.
You're so young, you can't believe it.
Yeah, you're too young.
I mean, it was the other day that they were the age of your children.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we were coming up here, and they were running up and down the road and embarrassing us. And just the baby, who will appear on Sunday, thank God, lives in the same city that we do, in Minneapolis. The other children are spread from Tokyo to Mannheim, Germany, and San Francisco. And it's how do you build community? You know, they're busy building careers and lives. And how do I hold my little chicks together now? Well, I look at the things you've just read, and I thought the trouble with the grandmother that you're thinking of and that little Matthew is thinking of is we aren't that kind of grandmother anymore. We are in the marketplace. And we aren't home baking cookies and sitting there and so on. So what can we do? Well, what I've done is that every Saturday or Sunday, since I don't have the dinner table sacred anymore, I sit down at the computer and I write a letter. Mm-hmm. And it's really almost turning into a book because it starts out, Dearest Children. And I relate my week and I tell what I've heard from each of them. So it becomes sort of a diary of the family for the week. And then I run off 4 copies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's
right.
At first I would embrace, you know, the personal parts to each child and write in a new part. And then I realized that that wasn't building community. What was building community was when I wrote a note to John and then wrote something mm-hmm. personal to Beth, or these things mm-hmm. would, you know, come up as they appear in the letter. And I have gotten comments back now from all the children about how much these letters mean to them. And so it is building.
I think that communication mm-hmm. is that kind of community building. It's written, it's oral, and it's not even said or unwritten. You know, it's not written or said at times. Still,
well,
is communication. That's
no
a nice comment.
Yeah. Really? Yeah.
And some people use a telephone for that, or you know.
Yeah, we do that a lot too. But I mean, it's expensive to phone line.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and I guess that's good to hear, have that input, because we are, I live in towns where, with my children, live in a town with my children, where both sets of grandparents are right there. And so, and it's really nice. But, you know, and so we're talking from a point of view where we are close. Now, I don't think his dad was growing up, his grandparents weren't around.
No, they were in Minneapolis.
The other thing about the telephone, unless you set up a conference call, you don't get what I'm talking about is writing to all 4 of them together mm-hmm. in
right.
the same way.
No.
That, I think, is what's building community more than my relating to this one, to this one,
yeah.
to this one.
That's excellent.
And this is the same thing that I find I train preschool teachers that they are not doing in the classroom. They are not relating the children to each other. They are relating like spokes and wheel instead of mm-hmm. tying together like a spiral.
Mm-hmm.
You did make the one comment about the dinner table, though some people do use that as kind of a mm-hmm. sacred time. At least they say the family will at least sit down to one meal together, and that's really tough when you start getting in the teen years and everyone is going on to an activity all around the community, or several activities that you have to get to.
Yeah.
Breakfast table is a possibility.
That has been better for me, the breakfast table, except my husband's not there at breakfast, but for the children, it's a better time to get myself and the children together. There's less disruptions because we're in baseball and soccer and ballet. And what do you have?
Were there any other comments? Did someone want to make some comment in the area of the concept of community building through family?
Okay. There's some statistics you were going to read from grandparents.
Oh.
And then there was the other one on by Robert Cole.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Okay.
This is this book shares some statistics on what the changing demographics of the American family. These are some jarring statistics that will show clearly why grandparenting is different in the changing times that we have. One out of every eight children in the United States now lives in a single-parent home. That's one out of eight lives in a single-parent home. I think it's higher than that. What's a copyright on this book?
I'd say
81. Yeah, that is an old statistic.
Yeah.
I think it's more than that,
it's
huh?
It's one out of every 10 lives with two natural parents.
One out of 10?
One out of 10. Natural parents. Both natural parents.
You know, yeah, these statistics are probably older than... yeah, those are some old statistics. I didn't realize that when I looked at that. Do you have any more statistics like that?
That was bad enough.
Yeah. That's terrible.
I found out this year that it was a real shock, but this came as part of the problem that teachers are having in school with
right.
kids, because a lot of it's coming from home. But the other 90% are living with one or the other of the parents, but not both parents.
Or step-family.
Yeah.
Or step-family.
Or foster family, or adopted family, or...
Yeah.
Or a group home.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder what percent live in a... So in a sense, we could probably say about 10% are living in a nuclear family home.
And that's for our whole school district.
Yeah.
Nuclear families are threatened species.
Yeah, the nuclear family is... isn't there anymore. I'm glad I read that because that brought that out.
Well, I don't know if Eugene, Oregon's different from other places, but that's what happens here.
I know that very much.
That sounds high to me, and just but I, you know, you have the data from your school situation.
School
yeah.
Our classroom in Springfield has about four nuclear families out of 31.
I have three foster kids out of every 10, and we figured out three foster out of every 10 that are not. Mm. Yeah, 10 in a foster home.
That'd be interesting to know how do you deal with that in your family? How do you establish that? That's your family.
That's your family.
When you take those children, that's your family. I'm just rather wondering how you deal
that's
with
that. That's what we're trying to work with it as educators. How we can instill some things that are part of the family in the kids in the school system so that they can have education that's similar to that.
Are there things that we can do as family members, it could be aunts, uncles, grandparents, to keep lines of communication open? Or to develop communication skills within our children, so they do learn how to communicate. Because if they with separated families, sometimes the communication skills they're not learning. Yes.
Yes.
I was just going to say, in those families where there's one single parent, I do believe that the grandparents live in the vicinity. They do help out because in our block there's a lady with three children. She's bringing them up by herself, but she does have a lot of support from her folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very helpful.
I think there are probably a lot of grandparents who actually have taken on the responsibility of child rearing.
Because normally a woman like that has to go out and work. She may get some support, but there's not quite enough. So that's where the grandparents come in. That's a good situation if it can be possible.
I sat next to a junior high kid at lunch one day at a business lunch, and some kids had been invited in from the community, and he really was a neat boy, but he told me the story of the fact that his mother had gone, and the father wasn't there, and he was living with his grandmother. He had a lot of respect for an uncle who was taking somewhat of the role of dad, and this wonderful grandmother who was had taken the responsibility. So I imagine that's the changing nature of our society too. Are there any signs that you see look more hopeful now down the road as you're doing that with education and foster children?
As a matter of fact, I don't know the exact numbers anymore because I just kind of glanced over, but I thought, gee, that's terrific. and I read it in our newspaper about, listen, 2 or 3 weeks ago or something like that, that the rate of divorce is slowly but surely going down.
I think I saw that statistic too.
So that's, there's hope there.
Okay. Okay, yes.
As loathsome as the AIDS issue has been in this country, I think that it has certainly heightened motivation for monogamy or for commitments in relationships, and that may have a spin-off process.
I've heard that too. I've heard people talk with that, and I've read articles too. Okay. Good point. Okay. How has your family or family life been influenced by grandparents or significant other older people? Have your lives been enriched by the wisdom of a grandma type person or grandpa type person? I mean, as some of you that are grandparents, even as you were growing up, what were some key, can you remember instances with your own grandparents or parents?
Well, I more or less, my mother worked when I was real little, and my grandmother was very definitely a very great influence on me. I mean, anything that Grandma said was perfectly fine. Grandma ate lard on bread, so I ate lard on bread. Anything that was good enough for her was good enough for me. And she died when I was 13 or 14. And I never changed that concept of my grandmother. You know, some people grow up, the kids grow up and they think, oh, Grandma, she's just, you know. I never had that. She was so important to me, even though my mother was very important to me too. But I mean, my grandmother was just so important to me and someone who I felt so very close to.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, she did live with us most of the time too. So that also, you know, Grandma didn't have a house of her own. You know, Grandma lived with us, you know, different one of us.
That was more customary in those days, too.
Yes, uh-huh. It wasn't unusual.
Yes.
Well, this is not the grandmother thing, but after my mother died, and 2 or 3 years later when my dad remarried, and I had a new mother, I had a stepmother. And this was a whole new world. I never knew my own grandparents because they were all in Norway, so I was born here in this country, so I didn't have the grandparent connection. But anyway, getting back to what I'm talking about, anyway, I had a stepmother. And gosh, some of the terrible horror stories I had read as a kid about stepmothers. And here is this lovely, lovely lady from Alberta, Canada, who is now my mom. And over the years, I watched this woman, and magnificent, to the point that I told myself years ago, now, Marilyn, if you ever become a stepmother, this is who you are going to copy. She was kind, loving, tender, considerate. Everything that I can think of good to say about her, and if she were here today, I would say it to her right here in her presence, and I already have. But years were to come and go, and lo and behold, one day, I found myself a stepmother. See, the worm turns. What goes around comes around, you know, the old saying. All of a sudden, I have 5 stepchildren in addition to 3 of my own. Then came the lesson. Well, I am going to be like Agnes. She kept her mouth shut. She didn't butt in where she wasn't wanted. She did her womanly duties when somebody had a baby. I mean, there she was, and all these good, fine qualities. But there's, with society like it is today, and all the changes and all the upheavals, she was the one person I wanted to become. And that's the way, and I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't had someone like that to copy. I really don't know. I probably would have been a terrible stepmother. I didn't want to be like the one in the storybooks. You know, and so I thought, well, but through this woman, I learned. And that's the kind of person I tried to be.
That's a really nice thought.
You just read a bunch.
Yeah. It's kind of, both of you mentioned it's kind of like a role model type of person, a type of relationship that you like to establish. I think we need more of that.
It reminds me of the commandment too, the one commandment test, the greatest promise for that kind of thing, honor your father and mother. We say honor your stepfather and your stepmother, or foster mother and foster father, and you will be blessed with long life. You like to see that in that, what the one commandment has that kind of promise, and that's reflected in that kind of story.
The next thing is, I guess, what you just said about your grandmother lived in your home. With the increasing life expectancy, and we're talking about extended family communications, what do you think your role, or how do you view our Christian responsibility to the older generation with the increasing life expectancy? What are we going to be doing?
We've done a couple of things in our own family. My mother had a stroke about 10 years ago. She died about 3 years ago. But we then proceeded to provide a home for her. I mean, it was could have gone to really a new, beautiful Lutheran home in Tacoma. But she had such a good recovery, it wasn't quite that comfortable. So we have a situation where I'm an only child at the present time, and my wife is an only child. And so we've had to kind of make those adjustments to make sure that our parents could be taken care of in that sense. It wasn't like having a lot of brothers and sisters where we could kind of share, which wasn't that important that we share the time. But we did that, and I think that as our generation is getting older, we are going to have to look at different ways of dealing with parents and with the increasing age life expectancy. We were lucky that we were able to do the same thing. My wife's an only child. We were able to bring her parents from another location and relocate them in an area where we could be close to them too. And I don't know if some of you had experiences on how we're going to deal with that as time goes on. I have quite a few friends now in Tacoma. One of my former students has kind of intermediate, a place that's in between a home and a convalescent center. I think more of those are going to grow too. He calls it a guest home rather than a convalescent center or what have you. And I'm just thinking that in our time as children, I'm 60 years old, and I don't think of myself, as a child anymore. But we're still children of our parents, and we're going to face that increasingly. And how we deal in a loving, caring way with the
who was 50 and was still living with his mother, was caring for her 21-year-old daughter who had just given birth to a deformed. Mm-hmm. Baby daughter, so now that's three generations. And this 50-year-old was also caring for her 70-year-old mother and her 90-year-old grandmother. So she was in the middle of five generations of women. She was the only one who was in a position to give the emotional support to all four of these.
Yeah, what a saint. There's a place reserved for her if she can live through it.
But,
yeah.
And so I think that's kind of what we're talking about, grandmas and the roles that grandmas are finding that they're playing. They're being grandmas, mothers, and children still.
You had a comment here, I know.
Oh, I was going to comment. I have a 97-year-old grandmother who's still living and still clear as a bell. And I think about my dad's comment, which my grandfather died 20 some years ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we'll get a duplex and put her next door. And and the other day he said, I never thought that she'd live 25 more years, next door.
Yeah.
I said, that it's really affected their retirement and their ability to travel. And, and he realized the other day, man, this has gone on a long time. Not that it's been a bad situation at all, but
I'd love to have my wife here too, Yeah. We have still have a mother-in-law who's young, very well, but it does take a day or two a week to make sure that all the shopping is done and there's a doctor's appointment and to go to the Norrlands Laget and the Sons of Norway. You know, you got it, lutefisk dinners, and so, you know, that's important.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's during a crisis is a poor time for a family to really make the best kind of decision.
Right.
And for our family, one of the best things is to try to be proactive. And so whenever we have a family occasion that's kind of happy, we adult children will sit down and we'll map out plans for the next couple of years of kind of different things. And it's been very helpful.
That's
so
a good
kind
thing.
Of everybody understands where we're coming from on different issues. And, well, if so-and-so gets ill, whose turn is it to take care and who's to bring her up for this surgery? And, you know, that type of logistics. And it's been very helpful. And for Ben and I know a lot of hard feelings. But anticipating that things are not going to be a bed of roses down the road and to kind of anticipate that and good planning. It's been very helpful.
I think you're a very unusual family, though, because I don't think most people can deal with that emotionally. They don't want to face the fact that we're getting older and we're going to die. And to me, that's part of life. And that's part of being a Christian, that dying is, you know, moving on a faith journey. And I don't understand this whole feeling, but it's very prevalent that we just can't talk about these things. Instead, we dye our hair and we get facelifts and
We had a crisis in our family with my wife's parents. We brought them from Pendleton, Oregon. Oh, how many years ago, Karen? It was quite a few years ago. Oh, it was so tough for Grandpa to leave Pendleton. I think it's almost tougher for the man than for the woman in that sense, because he lost his kind of autonomy. He lost his independence. And that was kind of tough. And so when he came, then we tried to make sure they had as much, you know, as much independence as you could possibly make for that situation. But I can remember one of the real difficult little decisions was just to buy grave plots when they were, you know, feeling good and healthy and everything else, you know, just a situation like that. So the way to do that was that Ingrid and I would buy ours at the same time. So now we have four right in the same place, one of which is used. So we felt that was kind of a nice answer. Then that resolved that we had to do it anyway. And so it was a good time for the four of us to do that together. And
one lady was telling me she didn't live in the same town as her mother did. Her father had been dead for many years. And she said she went to a talk one time on aging parents. And she said there the one thing that struck her, which she hoped that she could always carry out, was the fact that if you don't live in the same town that your parents do, but you have a brother or a sister or both or whatever in that town, and they are coping as best they can with the parents, you know, and they're doing all they can. Well, the thing you should never do is go home and say, I don't think you're doing this right. Yeah, because unless you want to go home and take over, you better keep your mouth shut and not say, and not do, because maybe if you were there, you wouldn't do everything just right either. And I think that's something to be remembered in this issue. You know, you were an only child, so you didn't have anybody else like that there. But a lot of times there are where there's quite, you know, more children than families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, having these grandparents and great aunts and uncles around, we grew up. It was a very rich kind of life for us, because we grew up respecting them, and we thought that they had some kind of wisdom, and we'd seek them out, and it works two ways, and it was wonderful as we were growing up. And somehow I think our parents instilled that into us, and maybe it was through our Sunday dinners. We kind of always got together Sunday afternoon for dinner, and there was the communication that went on around the table. I still remember that.
The only thing we had was my mother and Ingrid's mother, bless her soul, that she's gone. My mother was just an absolute arch Republican. Ingrid's mother's an arch Democrat. It was... We had to set them at one end, each end of the table. That was the only thing we had to arrange in that kind of arrangement. But,
we arranged by banning politics as a table.
You know, that's another way.
Wait, you know, my grandma's house by PLU, we had friends that would go argue politics with her. I mean, if they were studying at the PLU library, they'd just go on across the street and knock on the door and go visit with her. And they just had a, you know...
And check on the current state of the soaps at that time. We had one grandma that liked the soaps.
The soap opera. She introduced the Chinese girls and me to soap operas.
Well, anyway, that was...
It was funny. Do you have Mother Murphy's Laws?
I thought we might just end a little bit. Have any of you heard of Mother Murphy's Laws? I can't remember. But
we're starting to laugh. Is there anything you want to talk about grandparents right now anymore? Because we're going to move towards the part of, I think, of how important humor is. And being able to laugh at
humor. Being able to laugh a little at life.
Great.
Yes. I'm not sure where it fits in. I was thinking about this when you were asking the importance of grandparents in our lives. I did not know one of my grandparents and barely knew two because they died before I was really that old. My grandfather was very important to me. I could tell some incredible stories about him feeding wild animals and having bird land in his hand and this kind of stuff, which was very powerful to me. But I think what I was going to say is that even though I did not know them alive, I really know them through the stories that my parents told.
Oh, that's great.
And there's a sense, not only do I know my parents through those stories, but I also know my grandparents. I mean, I can remember any time we went on a trip in the car, we would always, and we knew the stories word for word, but we'd ask, oh, tell us the story about, and then we'd proceed to tell the whole story practically. But we would had all these sort of a family history of stories from both my mother and my father about their lives as children and so I know my aunts and my uncles through those stories, I know my grandparents. And I'm amazed when I talk to other people how they know almost nothing.
Yeah.
Or some people at least, how they know almost nothing about their parents' childhood, even where they lived, or what they did, what their grandparents did, those kinds of things.
I think there's
a real memory of history there that I feel really rooted about. I'm also aware that other people's family structures are not like mine. And those stories may be different in different contexts, but at least in my particular situation, those stories are extremely important to my sense of rootedness.
Precious, and they've become precious in a sense to your memory. That's really like that.
And I think as a parent, I've been hearing that here more through Marn, through her storytelling sessions, and to verbally express the family stories. I think my grandparents, we heard about, it was more through the sitting down with grandparents that we really heard more stories than we even did through our parents. And it's through, and I don't know, maybe it's a busyness, but one of my goals when I leave is to start telling the family stories.